Hello, and welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast. We cover the latest news, research, and analysis on China's growing presence in the developing world. I'm your co-host, Eric Mike Sterino, coming to you today from a pretty decent Durham, North Carolina. And as always, I am joined by my wonderful co-host, Juliet Liu, up in Ithaca. Juliet, how's it going?
Hi, Eric. I wanted to say we're recording this on February 1st, so chung jie kuai le to everyone.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I haven't watched the gala yet. I heard it was a pretty epic one this year.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's going to be a weekend activity for me.
I bet. Yeah. Well, before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone, if you'd like to stay up to date on the latest news, research, and analysis, and of course, join the discussion on all topics global China, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Great. So today we're going to be talking about banking, finance, and, you know, in our hyper-financialized, hyper-globalized world, debt is the grease on the wheels of nearly all economic activity. Debt is also a really complex social relationship that ties the lender and the borrower. We often think of it as going unidirectionally, but it is something that brings the lender and borrower into a specific kind of tie. And so the case in point being how the US and China's economies are very linked. When we talk about China's rise and the growing impact of the Belt and Road Initiative, I personally really find financing aspects of projects challenging to grasp, but once you understand it, it's just so important. As Chinese actors and institutions become some of the world's top financiers, they're redefining the flows and availability of capital, but they're also redefining China's relationship with the rest of the world and specifically the countries to which it lends. So it becomes a very kind of touchy subject and also a really important one to understand. We need tools to track and describe both the financial instruments that underwrite individual Belt and Road projects, and also the bigger picture of restructuring in China's relations with the rest of the world through financing and debt.
Which, luckily for us, we have just the person to talk about this today. We're talking today to Dr. Amar Malik. He's a senior researcher at ADATA. Dr. Malik leads the China Development Finance Program. His team develops the pioneering methods, such as the tracking underreported financial flows, TUF methodology, to track and analyze underreported financial flows from non-traditional donors to developing countries. I'm sure many listeners of the show have read their reports, have seen the database, and it's really phenomenal. Prior to joining ADATA, Dr. Malik was a director of research at Evidence for Policy Design, a research initiative at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he led research policy collaborations in the Middle East region by deploying evidence-based insights and training to improve public policies and leadership. Dr. Malik obtained his PhD in public policy from George Mason University, has his MA in public affairs from the Institut d'Études Politiques in Paris, has his MA in public policy from Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore, and a bachelor's in economics and mathematics from Lahore University of Management and Sciences. Amar, welcome to the Belt and Road Podcast.
Thank you very much, Eric and Juliet, for the introduction and for the opportunity to join you guys today. I'm a fan of the podcast, and I think it's a great platform for us to come and talk about these things that we all love to talk about. So very glad to be
here. Yeah, it's great to have you. So to start off, and we talked a little bit before we started recording about how important it is to have expertise from people who study China and expertise from people who study the countries in which China works. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in ADATA and their Global China Development Finance data set, and yeah, how you come to the topic and what you bring to it.
Yeah, of course. My background is in urban development and public policy. As Eric was saying, my PhD training is in public policy. For the most part, my research was focusing on urban and regional economics and the implications of highway and other infrastructure on the form and function of cities and regions. And within that framework, one of the most important elements that I was studying was how the introduction of new transport infrastructure, particularly rail and highways, but also bridges, tunnels, skyscrapers, and other things, how does that affect the performance of cities' economic systems? And in that, one of the signature initiatives of Chinese Belt and Road is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which the Chinese government has funded a number of highways in Pakistan. And it just so happened that one of my research projects was focused on evaluating the impact that those highways have had on markets and firms and their ability to export and to lower their costs of logistics, and also on households who presumably would benefit in the form of lower prices when the cost and time of moving things from place A to place B goes down. So then, within that framework, I started to understand that highways were being funded right, left, and center, not just in Pakistan, but around the world. So I just got interested in this topic. And one of the go-to sources of understanding where and how many highways were being funded, particularly by China, but also by other entities, I came across AidData's data set. This was years ago. And so since then, I just kept in touch with them and became a user of their data. And here I am leading the China Development Finance Program.
That's great.
Yeah. And, you know, I think many of us in the kind of global China field have been very thankful and also have very much utilized AidData's data, especially on Chinese development projects, and it's found it incredibly useful. I'm very familiar with the old data set. I haven't really gone much into the new one because I'm not in graduate school anymore and I don't use it for work. But last September, you released a major policy report that was heavily publicized and gained lots of traction within mainstream media outlets, and also was this a major update and resource for all researchers out there. So can you give an overview of the history of AidData's Global Chinese Development Finance data set? And what's new in version 2.0 that you released late last year?
Yes, I think the story of how AidData started and started working on this topic is quite interesting, and one that, you know, I certainly got attracted to when I decided to join them last year. You know, first of all, I think in my own career, I focused a lot on evidence-based policymaking and this idea that, you know, public decision-making in the real world should always, to the extent possible, be informed by objective and rigorously created evidence. And of course, in the real world, that doesn't happen often. So in that spirit, William & Mary, being a first-rate undergraduate training institution, has a steady stream of highly talented, very creative students who pass through. And a group of students, I would say about 10 years or so ago, asked this question of why China's overseas development financing activities didn't have the same level of transparency or weren't reported as consistently as by traditional Western donors. As you know, a lot of the traditional donors are part of the Development Assistance Committee of the OECD, and they are systematically reporting their activity at the project level every year on the credit reporting system. And the question was, you know, why does China not do that? And of course, as international relations professors would explain to their students, there's lots of different reasons for that. Ideological: China does not participate in those institutions, is not a member of the OECD, doesn't feel obligated to do it, and the portfolio of their engagements overseas are quite complex. And so the students set out to create a methodology in the very beginning, and then quickly that methodology became taken on by a group of academics, later formed AidData. And today it's a major program. In any given year, we hire over 100 research assistants. We have a team of about 10, 12 people working full-time on this initiative. And yes, we recently released what we call version 2.0, which is a major update as compared to the earlier version. So let me give you basically three or four main features that we've updated in this data set. First of all, the scope and scale has expanded. We have now coverage from commitment years 2000 to 2017. We now cover 145 countries. We have drastically improved the reliance on official sources as opposed to open sources or media sources. 89% of our projects are now underpinned by at least one official source. And I can go into details of what I mean by official sources. We basically have expanded our coverage in terms of the details of the financial flows. For many more projects, we have information on loan terms. And it is also very comprehensive in the sense that we do not focus on a single sector or a single region of the world or a single type of financing institution within China, but we cover basically the entire universe of Chinese overseas development finance activities. And one other thing that I think is very important is that we have expanded by offering now a very detailed project descriptions, on average about 140 words, for the 13,427 projects that we cover. That is basically around 2 million words total, which can be used by researchers for all sorts of applications. So yeah, I would say that this is an entirely new and fully updated data set in which we've not just provided three additional years of coverage, but have actually gone back and updated the entire data set that you, Eric, and others have used in the past, which covered us from 2000 to 2014.
Yeah, it's an impressive project. Amar, can you give us a bit of a breakdown of what's included in the data set? What do you guys draw on? You've kind of touched on this already, so just whatever highlights you see as important.
Yeah. So let me just break this down for you, maybe in terms of some numbers that you might be interested in. In the course of developing this data set, as I said, we have 13,427 projects. We have used 91,000 sources to put this data together. All of these sources are available on our website and you can download it easily. A third of these sources, or more than a third of these sources, are actually official sources. which means that these are coming from Chinese government websites, Chinese embassy websites, gazettes issued by host governments, Ministry of Finance, debt disclosure documentation, parliamentary proceedings, and so on. I think that is a major improvement, as I was saying earlier. Now, in the course of this work, we have identified more than 300 official sector lenders and donors in China, which are not just government ministries, but also state-owned banks and state-owned enterprises. To give you an idea of the scale of this, for over 3,100 loans all around the world, you can find in our data set that we have recorded interest rates for 1,600 out of them, and we have recorded maturity length for over 1,900 loans, and the grace periods are available for almost 1,300 of them. So it's a huge data set that gives you the ability to go deep into the financing structures of projects around the world. In addition to the Chinese entities that are classified as funders, we have also identified 460 co-financing institutions, or 2,450 recipient institutions. These include government agencies and recipient governments. This could be joint ventures, and they could also be special purpose vehicles. We have also identified over 3,500 implementing agencies, which are basically contractors, government, non-government entities that are involved in actually undertaking activities on the ground. And we have also identified 227 third parties, which we call accountable agencies, that are involved in providing repayment guarantees, credit insurance, or providing collateral. The other thing is that in addition to, you know, giving this sort of network of actors who participate in this massive global program, we have also gotten much better at recording the precise implementation details of these projects. So I would say that over 5,500 out of our 13,427 projects, you will find precise start dates for the projects, which means that you will know exactly when the intervention got turned on, so to speak. 6,000 projects, you will find precise project completion dates. That means that as a researcher, you are now much more able to do temporal variation studies. So, for example, if you wanted to study the impact of a given project on public opinion toward China or other issues, you could now know exactly when the project was announced, when it was started, when it was completed, and so on. In addition to the temporal variation, there's also much greater geographical precision, which we've put in a lot of work to do. And I think it's a treasure trove of information for those of us who work in geospatial studies or geospatial economics. So for 3,285 projects, we now have recorded the physical footprints of projects. So basically, if it's a transmission line, we not only say the name of the district where the transmission line is, but we actually draw them using OpenStreetMaps. And then we have created on GitHub a repository, which is linked to our website, where you can actually do geospatial analysis. We basically use the project descriptions that I was talking about earlier and the official sources to find out where the projects are located. And OpenStreetMap has been incredibly helpful in having us do it. So now what that means for researchers is that, you know, you can get more precise in your estimations of the localized economic impacts or environmental hazards or whatever else you might be interested in. So all in all, I would say that this data set is one that offers researchers, academics, and policymakers tremendous opportunities to undertake research, hopefully for years to come.
Yeah, that's incredible. I was especially, when I was reading the report, taken aback at how much detail you're able to get on interest rates and maturity rates. As I think lots of us know, these kind of loan details are very difficult to find. And so being able to have that was incredible. Also the geospatial data for all those who work in geospatial analysis. Are places that are geolocated, are they places that are known to already be under construction or constructed, or if it's something planned to be implemented, like that power line?
It's a mixed bag, Eric. What happens is, because we rely on OpenStreetMap, it's just an incredible source. Like Wikipedia, it's a source where a lot of people actually go in and create landmarks. And what we do is we have a whole process where we use satellite imagery and landmarks on the ground on OpenStreetMaps to make sure that we are able to then match up the description that is provided with what we see on the ground. For example, if it says in the description that China Exim Bank has funded a 44-kilometer segment of a highway that goes from city A to city B, if that highway doesn't exist or is in the works and we don't see any evidence of activity on the ground with satellite imagery, it's one thing where you could easily draw like a straight line from point A to point B. But increasingly, what we see is that as the quality of satellite imagery improves, as the frequency of satellite imagery improves, we are now able to draw precise lines, you know, the winding road that kind of avoids that mountain or goes through a tunnel or whatever that might be. We are able to now follow those landmarks around, and you can see like a lot of like zigzag roads going back and forth. And similarly, if it's about, let's say, a power plant, satellite imagery now allows you to see when they start to clear out the site. Often they would, if it's a green area, they would clear out the trees, and then they would sometimes put a boundary wall. Then when the actual building gets constructed, you can see that as well. And the beauty of providing GeoJSONs, which is like a file format for geospatial analysis, is that even if 5 years from now, somebody wants to study a given project, they can open that GeoJSON file, put it on a map, a satellite image, and be able to see what the latest situation is. We are now experimenting with using automated systems that would let us let the machines go and read satellite images as they come in every quarter, every year, whatever the frequency might be, and then give us more update information on what the status of the project is.
Yeah, well, that's incredible. I can't actually wait to go into this data. So the specific data set that was released, as you said, it was expanded. So now it goes from the year 2000 to 2017. What are the general trends that you saw in Chinese lending? What does the data show? Has there been any geographic or sectoral or structural changes? Was the Belt and Road Initiative a turning point in lending to any sectors or regions?
This is one of the beauties of having a data set over time and then being able to talk about the trends, because I think that's incredibly important to talk at sort of the high level. Several things, I'll highlight a few and then happy to go deeper into any of these. So first thing that we note is that during the Belt and Road era, and we mean since the announcement of the Belt and Road, China is now outspending the US on a more than 2-to-1 basis and the United Kingdom on a more than 7-to-1 basis, which means that we are now recording average annual development finance from China, both ODA and OOF. These commitments are now in the range of $85 billion a year.
Go into ODA and OFF for listeners who don't know.
Of course. ODA stands for Overseas Development Assistance. What that means is that according to the OECD's guidelines, and let me also explain what OECD is. OECD is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. This is a member organization consisting of 20-something members, popularly known as the Rich Countries Club. But OECD does a lot of public good work in foreign aid and assistance. And for years, they've set out the guidelines and standards for how different kinds of foreign aid ought to be classified. And for aid data, it's very important to follow those guidelines so that Chinese spending can be analyzed apples to apples with financing that is coming out of other countries. So coming back to your question, Eric, on ODA, there's three conditions that have to be met for something to be classified as development assistance or popularly known as aid. First is there should be clear development intent. Second, the lending has to be concessional. The OECD provides a grant element calculator, which basically lets you estimate, given the terms and conditions that you see, it tells you how much concessionality has been offered. So if it's more than 25% concessional, that is a criteria that you have to meet. And the third is that the country that receives the funding has to be ODA eligible. So let's say if Oman, for example, gets a project which has development intent and is concessional, regardless of which donor it gets it from, Oman is not an ODA eligible country, therefore that would not be considered as ODA. OOF, on the other hand, other official flows, is a different category in itself. And you can think of those more as loans that are provided by China. And what we see in our data set is that China, since 2013, has maintained a 9-to-1 ratio of OOF to ODA. So you can think that there's a lot more loans than there is aid, or more grants and loans than aid. And that is why the scale of Chinese spending is so much larger than some of the Western counterparts that we are more accustomed to reading about. Another interesting thing is that when you talk about overseas loans from China, in our data set, we find that the average interest rate is 4.2%. Whereas a typical loan from a country like Germany or France or Japan is at 1.1% interest rate. And I think the reason is that China is more likely to go into riskier places and they are much more aggressive in spending larger sums of money in larger projects, especially infrastructure projects. And that in part explains why the interest rates are higher. The other thing that we see in our data set is that there is a rising level of credit risk because Chinese are now spending much more money in mega projects and larger loans since the BRI started. And so the percentage of Beijing's overseas lending portfolio that benefits from at least one repayment safeguard, like collateral or credit insurance or a third-party repayment, has also gone up in the Belt and Road era from 30% to 60%. So simple logic is if you're going into more risky environments, you need protection, and those protections come from one of these three mechanisms, as I said, collateral, credit insurance, or third-party repayment guarantee. We are seeing that the Chinese state-owned lenders that we are finding in our data set, we believe that they are simply acting as yield-maximizing surrogates of the state, which means that they are prioritizing profitable revenue-generating projects. That is why the scale of this thing has become so large. The other thing is, when you think of like large trends and you think of Belt and Road era and these big numbers, I think you have to also contextualize them properly. So a lot of attention obviously focuses on China and China's intentions overseas and the impact that it's having globally. But we also think that China is also solving an internal economic problem. Of course, China has, a domestic industrial input overproduction problem. So it is basically moving that capacity overseas. China has surplus of dollars and euros, and it's difficult for them to find attractive returns at home. And so it makes sense to find profitable projects overseas and invest those in providing infrastructure to developing countries, because a lot of these loans are now more likely to be dollar and euro denominated. And the rates of returns are pretty healthy, as I noted earlier. So I think the fundamental thing that we have to understand in terms of the context of the big picture and the trend that we've seen is that there are supply side factors that are driving the rise of Chinese overseas financing in the Belt and Road era. For those of you who know the going out strategy from the late 1990s and the early 2000s, we feel this is just a thinly veiled extension and expansion of that strategy. And it is now being implemented under the banner of the Belt and Road. So when we drill down into the credit allocation strategy that is put in place as part of China's overseas development program, we see that they are now, since the 2008 global financial crisis, when, of course, returns in U.S. treasuries became much, much less attractive with lower interest rates set in the U.S., China has been following what we might term as a high-risk, high-reward credit allocation strategy. And we see that there are especially high interest rates, around 6%, attached to loans that are issued to borrower countries that pose the highest levels of fiduciary risks and repayment risks. As I mentioned, there are three kinds of repayment guarantees that China relies on. And the most popular one, which underpins about 44% of the lending, is the concept of collateral or collateralization. So we can think of collateralization as a go-to risk mitigation strategy. We find that 40 out of the 50 largest loans in China's overseas lending portfolio are in fact collateralized. We find also that, again, this makes complete sense when you think of financing for commercial purposes or even development purposes, that Chinese state-owned lenders tend to favor collateralization when they lend to countries that pose especially high levels of fiduciary risks. So we find that 83% of China's collateralized lending supports countries within the bottom quartile of the global index of fiduciary risk. So when you go to riskier places, you are more likely to ask for collateral and more likely to get collateral because both sides know that the risks are pretty high. The other thing we find is that, as opposed to perhaps the popular perception that may have been created by the media, there is a strong preference to collateralize on liquid assets in lender-controlled bank accounts, sometimes with minimum cash balance requirements in riskier places, rather than illiquid assets, which would require you to go to a court and then sell it off and get paid that way. So I think that is also a misperception that needs to be corrected, that in fact, there's a lot of collateralization taking place in liquid assets, which again, as I said earlier, in riskier places makes a lot more sense from the perspective of the creditor.
You pointed out many of the trends from 2000 to 2017. Before we go into more things about debt and the hidden debt aspects of the report, from knowledge of other data sets and this general trend following on global China, I think one can make a pretty good assumption that lending has actually changed quite a bit from 2017. For instance, there's been a large reduction in policy bank spending that some other data sets have found out. Is the team at ADATA continuing the collection of this data? And do you have any preliminary insights on post-2017 lending?
Yeah, that's an important point. Because of the fact, Eric, that we cover such a large scope of countries and sectors and lending instruments. We have coverage for projects that were committed until 2017. Now, that doesn't mean that we do not, in the status variable, that we do not look into the current status of those projects. So there's always, you know, a bit of a lag. If a project was committed in 2017, it may or may not have started activities on the ground that year. And certainly for large infrastructure projects, it sometimes isn't possible to even close out a project within 3 years. So you can think of this as data set that covers commitment year until 2017, but the implementation status of project is current to 2021, which is the summer of 2021, which is when we finalized the data set. And yes, to your question, we are in the process as we speak of moving this data set forward to commitment years 2018, 2019, and others. I can't say much about those trends. Another distinct feature you can get, it's a unique feature of our data set, is that because we cover not just policy banks, but also state-owned commercial banks, state-owned enterprises, that we find that those entities have picked up their activity level in the last few years. So we will be curious and keep an eye on what happens. And in the coming months, you'll see a data release newer years. And hopefully soon enough, we will become more current. And so within a lag of a few months, you will be able to see the previous year's data. But as you can imagine, it is a huge operation, and the amount of work that it takes to do this responsibly and in a way that's rigorous and worthy of everybody's attention is the trade-off that we make sometimes to make sure the data is comprehensive and accurate.
Yeah, and hard when it's a topic that's changing so quickly. So one of the major findings of your report is this increase in what you call hidden debt to China. And I also want to flag that, you know, you guys have called it hidden debt, and it's a good way to grab attention. But in the context of the media picking up so much on the debt trap narrative and how much debate there has been around, is it a debt trap? Is that a fair characterization? You guys have gone to great lengths to kind of respond to misunderstandings around hidden debt. How do you define hidden debt? Are debts equally distributed across the BRI?
So first of all, let me contextualize this. You know, first thing that we find from a public financial management perspective is that low-income countries and middle-income countries now have substantially higher levels of public debt exposure to China than was previously understood. We found, for example, that 42 countries are at or above 10% of their GDP threshold. So the amount of money they owe to China is at or more than 10% of their GDP. We find that a major transition has taken place during implementation of the Belt and Road era. 70% of China's overseas lending is now directed to state-owned companies, state-owned banks, special-purpose vehicles, joint ventures, and private sector institutions. So it's not as simple as the government of Angola taking on a loan directly on their books, but there are all these other instruments that are being used. As I've said previously, you know, these debts, for the most part, do not really appear on government balance sheet in these countries. So that is one contextual factor that I think you need to understand. The other thing, before I talk specifically about how we define hidden debt, is that most of this lending benefits from some sort of explicit or implicit host government liability protection. And that has blurred the lines between private and public debt. For example, in a country like Pakistan, there are major energy investments that have been made in the last 7 or 8 years. None of those investments have gone directly to the government of Pakistan. They have gone into equity, debt, combination, special purpose vehicles that have been created just to create those energy projects, where 20% equity is provided by mostly local private sector entities and 70% comes from debt. There is an implicit understanding that if some of these projects go belly up, that the government will come in and save the day. And that has happened recently in Indonesia as well in one of the projects. So that's something that we all need to be aware of and understand. Now, as far as the specific question of hidden debt is concerned, you may know that the World Bank, since the 1950s, has a debtor reporting system where all member states are supposed to report their debt obligations to the World Bank so that everybody is well informed and, you know, the future lenders know what the country owes at the moment. And what we find in our data is that an average lower middle-income country government is underreporting its actual and potential repayment obligations to China. by an amount that is equivalent to 5.8% of their GDP. And we're talking about $385 billion. So the gap between what we are finding as their obligations or potential obligations to China and what they are reporting to the World Bank amounts to $385 billion, which is what we call hidden debt. And we also find that this sort of underreporting problem is getting worse over time. So during the Belt and Road era, average annual underreporting of repayment liabilities to official sector creditors in China was $13 billion. But this figure has skyrocketed to $40 billion during the last 5 years. So if you think about this problem of hidden debt from the perspective of a Ministry of Finance official, it is what we call a phantom menace. That means that it is not so much about how much you owe to China, but it's about not knowing what you owe to China. It's like being obligated to service these undisclosed debts. And I think that's something that we need to be cognizant of. And we just want this data to generate a debate. Of course, if you look at the Banking and the Belt and Road report, figure 21 gives you a chart where you can see how we came up with these calculations and where each and every country in our data set stands on this. I can go into some of the detail as to why this underreporting problem exists in the first place and why it's getting worse. But it certainly is something in the benefit of the global financial system. I think something that we need to have more discussions on.
I totally agree. And I like how you frame it as the changes over time are also kind of built in. China is not the only factor that's shifting, right? It's also the behavior of reporting of countries that are taking on these debts. Maybe we can talk about the China-Laos Railway as one of these examples of risks of China's hidden debt. It's an example used a lot in the media to kind of show the risks that China imposes upon countries that it lends to. It's a case that you spend a lot of time discussing. You and Brad have a subsequent brief that I think that the listeners should look at as well. You use that example as something that shows how complicated the potential risks of hidden debt are and why debt relations are complex, are not just unilateral China imposing debt upon host countries.
Yeah, it's an interesting case. And I know there's people who've written at length about this case. And if you look at our report, the Banking and the Belt and Road report, there's a text box, I think it's box 3, which talks at length about this. Just for context, this is a 418-kilometer railway segment between Laos capital and the China-Laos border. A shell company called the Laos-China Railway Company, or LCRC, was created to facilitate this. It's a limited liability corporation and a joint venture between three state-owned companies, which have a total of 70% ownership stake, and the Laotian state-owned enterprise has a 30% stake in this. So it's a combination, it's a 70-30 combination. So China Exim Bank issued a $3.54 billion debt to the LCRC to support the construction of the railway, which of course, as you understand, it's a public infrastructure asset that will be available to Laotian businesses and to Chinese partners and the public to use. Now, the question is, you know, how should the Laotian government's repayment obligations for this project be characterized? So the point that we make in that brief that you mentioned is that given that it does not hold a majority ownership stake in the LCRC, the Laotian government does not report any repayment obligation to the World Bank's debtor reporting system, which, you know, technically speaking, is perhaps in line with those guidelines. I must say that I haven't read the full documentation on what should and shouldn't be reporting to the debtor reporting system, but that's the presumption that we're working with. The problem is that the proposition that the LCRC does not pose any insolvency risk to the Laotian government is a problem. If the project is not able to generate enough revenues to repay the loan that has been taken, the mere scale of the lending is so large that it could create very serious problems for the Laotian government. And of course, Western or other institutions who might then have to come into action and try to salvage the project or try to salvage the situation.
Much of the expansion of hidden debt really stems from the increased use of special purpose vehicles. These are specific companies that are created usually in the host country jurisdiction that are only utilized as a legal entity for a project. These projects tend to have Chinese, usually state-owned enterprises, holding equity, oftentimes majority stakes, in an infrastructure project. So when you have a Chinese entity, state-owned enterprise, who maybe is getting loans from a Chinese state-owned commercial bank or a syndicate of banks, some from Chinese state-owned enterprise, state-owned commercial banks, and maybe some local banks or banks from Europe or the US or from Russia or a whole host of countries, what risk can a host country have in an infrastructure project when the Chinese state-owned firm is also putting their money at risk because they are the ones who are the legal entity who should be repaying that loan?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And of course, you're raising a lot of different aspects, but maybe I'll clarify this by giving you the example of Pakistan. I was there recently and I had the opportunity to discuss this firsthand with people who were involved in creating the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So in 2013, the then government of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif won the election. The election was won on a single agenda, which was to solve the power crisis. The country had a 30 to 35% shortfall of power generation. And the entire economy was in doldrums as a result of that. So one of the first things that the government did was to go to China and say, you know, we really need you to come and finance these power projects. And lo and behold, with really strong support from the government, within a matter of months, multiple power plants were started. Within, I would say, 30 months in some cases, a few coal power plants were brought online. So slowly, Pakistan's energy problems started getting resolved. Now, the structure of the lending is where the problem is. In fact, the structure of Pakistan's energy sector is a very big problem. And the reason is that under the local energy policy, the government of Pakistan is the sole buyer of all power that is produced by any entities, whether they are Chinese sponsored projects or other projects that have come. Some of them have even been funded by the World Bank or the IFC. Now, when the government of Pakistan is the sole buyer of electricity, the model is that we will buy electricity from whoever produces it. We will then sell it to the customers. And then from the returns that we get from that, we will repay our debt obligations. Now, often, as you may know, in buying car loans or sometimes mortgage, you don't really become obligated to repay those loans immediately. But what happens is that over time, over 3 years or 5 years, you start to repay them depending on the maturity or the grace period of the loan. Now, in Pakistan's case, the challenge is that a lot of these projects have been, or I would say all of these projects have been financed in dollar-denominated loans. The government of Pakistan is obligated to repay the Chinese creditors and Pakistani creditors handsomely in US dollars, but electricity is sold to the Pakistani customers in rupees. And over the last 3 years, the Pakistani rupee has devalued by at least 30%. Or 35%, which means that every time the Pakistani rupee loses value to the US dollar, the government of Pakistan's liability in dollar terms is the same, but in rupee terms, it increases dramatically. Then they are in a bit of a pickle, to say the least. And as the government faces more and more pressure to not keep raising power prices, because again, remember, Pakistan still is one of the poorest countries in the world, and the Pakistani population does not have the ability to keep paying more and more for power. I think the gap between what they are able to earn and what they owe to the Chinese and other creditors is going to grow. So I think that's where the problem is, Eric. And this is just one illustration, but there are many other examples of this sort of situation emerging in the years ahead.
That absolutely makes sense. And I'm less familiar with Pakistan. I am more familiar with Myanmar and Cote d'Ivoire countries, especially within the energy sector, when they have public-private partnerships with Chinese entities or otherwise, they'll have these return guarantees on, you know, you build this dam, you build this solar park, you build whatever type of energy there is. You'll have a 15% net return after the end of your 20 years in the right. BOT development, which in a country like Myanmar, which already pre-coup subsidized electricity greatly for the people, so they weren't even profiting on the sale of electricity in the end. It makes it very difficult to pay off debt obligations. But yeah, very interesting. As you stated within this Pakistan example, especially public-private partnerships, which tend to end up being special purpose vehicles, you know, these are things that the Western multilateral development organizations, the World Bank, you mean, they've worked on cooperative programs with many different developing countries to build in PPPs within energy sectors or other sectors, which then creates this type of hidden debt, whether it be with Chinese stakeholders or other large multinationals like Exxon. Russia has lots of projects abroad, especially in Central Asia and Africa, Turkey, Japan, Korea. Is there a specific difference between Chinese stakeholders and these other large ones, or is the main difference in terms of hidden debt, or is the main difference just there's just so much activity coming from China and Chinese entities?
That's a good question, Eric. I think when I talk to stakeholders in Pakistan, these are people who helped create all of these deals that resulted in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. They told us that initially, when they were looking for power projects, they had gone to American companies like the GEs of the world, the turbine manufacturers, and asked them to come and invest in Pakistan. at the time, they were not willing to invest in Pakistan's energy sector because, again, the country was in the middle of a major insurgency and they weren't sure if Pakistan was a safe place for them to come and invest in energy. And so they said that initially they had gone to Chinese banks asking for money to help finance these power plants that would be where the equipment would be provided by the Americans, and they were going to hire other contractors to come install them. But they were told by the Chinese side that, you know, the way that they would operate is that while they were willing to come and make those loans available to Pakistan, that they would bring in an entire package. They would bring in the implementation partners, the plans would be set in stone, and that they would then come in and do the construction as well. And I think for them, for the Pakistani side, desperate to get their power grid fully functional, this was a bit of a no-brainer, because they had gone to the Middle Eastern banks who said, we can't fund you. They had gone to the Americans and they said no. So for them to come in and work with the Chinese was a no-brainer. So I think one distinctive feature of this is that they brought this package, and that they were able to, in some cases, as I said, within less than 3 years, they were able to get power projects online, which was amazing for a government which faces a five-year election cycle. So I think that's one thing that's distinctive. But on the other hand, I would say, as compared to perhaps some of the financial institutions that you mentioned, the World Bank and the IFC, there is not a lot of documentation available on the project preparation. When the World Bank puts any project forward, you can find all of that information on their website, the package that goes to the board for approval, the assumptions that were made to build the financial model, the risks and environmental factors. Perhaps all of these things are done in this case as well, but certainly these documentations and this detail is never made available to the public. And that is, I think, again, another fundamental difference between the two. But yeah, of course, you're also right that just the sheer scale at which this is happening and the speed at which this is happening around the world, that also is obviously a distinctive feature of the way China goes about delivering these projects.
Yeah, a great balance between these really specific differences you see and the bigger picture. Last question, just to wrap things up a bit and reflect on the work that you've been doing. You have this huge database there's actually multiple databases that ADATA has created. They're open to anyone to use. What are the ways that you've seen this being used in exciting ways that go beyond your report? And are there things that you hope people pick up and do more work on in the future?
I can speak for a whole hour in response to this. So I'll go back to your original question about my own journey and how I arrived here. You know, one of the exciting things about taking on this role as the lead for this program was the ability to not just be a team that aggregates and reports data as a public good, which is great, and we've done quite a bit of that, but also a team that helps shape the research policy agenda, both in-house with research projects done with colleagues here at ADATA, but also more importantly with colleagues like yourselves and others who are listening to this podcast around the world. We see our role as being a bit of a hub and an amplifier, and our role is to make a good, reliable data accurately recorded and reported regularly and with a lot of detail available to people who want to use it. The last data set that we had released in 2017 has resulted in over 250 papers, and the applications range anywhere from, you know, health sector to study health systems to energy and environmental issues to the political economy of aid delivery and so on. A few areas where I think we should invest as a community of researchers include, first of all, the environmental side of things, that coal-based power plants have become out of fashion. China has continued to finance coal-based power plants up until recently. So what kind of air quality impacts, if any, have they generated? We have now precise locations of those power plants. We know when they were turned on. And so environmental scientists, perhaps like yourself, Juliet, could dig into that. And I think that would make for some interesting research. Okay. People who work and worry about public health and global health, I think they have been telling me after looking at this data that there is a general lack of understanding of China's large role in global health, at least as far as Africa is concerned. And in our data set, we have recorded incident after incident of Chinese medical teams coming and delivering directly by setting up clinics. We've also seen Chinese donations of hospitals and equipment and so on. So the question is, you know, what is distinctive about the Chinese way of doing things as far as health is concerned? Are they more likely to go into a direct public health delivery, or are they more likely to provide more infrastructure? Then, of course, as far as financing and debt sustainability is concerned, I think there's big questions around debt sustainability risks. What's a public debt and what's not public debt? and also what will happen as more and more countries are perhaps unable to repay their debt obligations. How will these loans be restructured? And there's all this financing aspect to this that needs to be understood. Another line that I think is quite interesting, it would be to study what we call networks of the Belt and Road. So when, where, and how do different combinations of financiers, co-financiers, implementation partners, others get involved? Why is it that a state-owned enterprise from province A is more likely to go into Angola and not to Nigeria? Is there something about their specialization, their sector, the way that they function, or the financing that works, or the partnerships they have with their fellow state-owned enterprises in China? Or is there something else about it? Maybe there is some kind of legacy or path dependency because of historical factors. So I think that's very interesting to understand. You mentioned other data sets. When I talk about our data set, it means basically the Chinese development finance data set. But our colleagues, Sam Custer and team, have also been looking at China's soft power. And one of the things that you'll find in both this data set and the other data set is Chinese grants or gifts to social and cultural projects. So a lot of stadiums, a lot of arts councils, airports and strategic locations, and so on. What impact does that have on the so-called elites in developing countries? Because, you know, let's admit it, a big fancy sports venue in the capital city is not going to be accessible to the vast majority of people in that country. It has a particular purpose as a gift from China to that country. So what impact does that have on the elites of those countries? That's another question that I think is worth studying. I've listed about 6 things, but as I said, I can go on for an hour talking about other ideas. I really hope people will, after listening to this podcast, will take the time to dig into the data and explore it for themselves, because I'm sure there's things that we haven't thought of yet that are worth exploring.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. And Amar, thank you for chatting with us today. It's been a really rich conversation and one that we've really enjoyed.
Thank you very much, Juliet and Eric. Thank you for doing this podcast. And I hope that we continue to engage and to learn from each other through this platform that you've created. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Belt and Road podcast. Remember, if you want to stay up to date on the Belt and Road Initiative, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Belt and Road Pod.
Amar, what would you recommend for our listeners?
Well, for those of you who are interested in looking at the world from a geographical lens, I think you will really enjoy this new working paper written by Richard Bloom and colleagues called Connective Financing. The subtitle is Chinese Infrastructure Projects and the Diffusion of Economic Activity in Developing Countries. And they do a very good job in explaining how economic activity gets diffused through the introduction of infrastructure. Because remember, at the end of the day, Belt and Road is simply a network of connectivities. And by titling it Connective Financing, I think they're making the point that you need to understand Belt and Road as a network of interventions. And I think they've done a great job in getting us thinking about a geographical lens of looking at Belt and Road.
I have two today. One, I finally have a global China-based one. It's another one by Margaret Myers. We had her on the show earlier, and we're going to have her on the show going forward to talk about this. It's called Going Out Guaranteed, Chinese Insurers in Latin America. Political risk insurance, infrastructure insurance, other types of insurance are incredibly important for large-scale infrastructure projects, and the going out of Chinese insurers for these types of projects and the internationalization of them is a topic that's severely understudied. It's a free PDF and it's really great, so go check that out. And secondly, I think I recommended this last year, but I just finished the second season of the HBO show How To with John Wilson. And it's one of my favorite TV shows of all time. It has a very incredible, unique, and humanistic tone that I've never seen from another show. John Wilson does a bunch of first-person accounts of New York City and tries to explain how to do something, but then it turns into this really kind of magical journey of interesting subcultures and parts of America and New York City that you probably haven't seen before. I wish there were more episodes I've seen. There's only 6, so it's a quick watch too. But How To with John Wilson. And Juliet, how about you?
So my recommendation is, this is coming from who is one of my supervisors here at Cornell, and he's just a great China scholar. There's been a controversy on Twitter, of course, about an article published by a political scientist. His last name is Mitiga, and it talks about environmental authoritarianism. It's been responded to by a number of people, and the debate is kind of like, does authoritarianism produce environmental benefits better than liberal democracies do? The debate gets into that and whether climate change the lack of progress in climate change is legitimizing authoritarian governments because, you know, democratic liberal governments have not made enough progress. And it's an interesting debate, and it's a really good one for thinking through how complicated climate change is and authoritarianism. And so I'll leave a link to that in our show notes.
Nice note to end on. But Amar, thank you so much again for joining us in the Belt and Road podcast.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.